better financially girded for prolonged war, it had to be worried about losing the support of the people in its districts. Ordinary jadeless citizens need not fear being active targets of greenbone violence, but sometimes there were collateral casualties, and property and economic damage were inevitable. Once the Academy graduates joined No Peak in the spring, the conflict would surge further, and the city would suffer more. On top of that, given public censure from the audit of the Kaycon Jade Alliance and the pending passage of oversight legislation, the Mountain surely wanted to secure victory soon. Once it did, Chancellor Soane would be out of power, and Ait Mata could pressure the Royal Council to drop the issue. "Look at me," Hilo thought wryly, "actually thinking about all the political bullshit." Perhaps he was learning, gradually, to be a pillar after all. Too little too late, though. Politics moved slowly, and blades moved fast. "Gaunt won't intimidate us with crude savagery," Ken insisted, pouring them both another shot of Hoji. "Every greenbone down to the lowest finger would give his life for you, Jen. Gaunt wants a quick victory? He won't get anything of the sort." Hilo had never shied away from any fight, and he was willing to wage a long and brutal war if that was what was required to overcome his enemies. But if defeat was on the inevitable horizon, then he held no pointless desire for any more of his fists or fingers to lose their limbs or their jade. He would value a clean death for himself and his loved ones. It was, in truth, not so bad a trade Gaunt was offering him. The idea of dying for the clan was not rhetoric to Hilo. The clan was an extension of family, in some ways more family to Hilo than his own kin. He had never known his father. His mother had loved Lon. His grandfather had loved Shay. Hilo had found his place in the world among peers. That was where his expressiveness and daring were valued. Now the clan was relying on him in a very real and personal way. Ken and Tar, his other fists, like Juen and Vuei, poor Aten and Sato and Lot, who deserved their vengeance, all the way down to the fingers like Pano and that kid, Heijo, who'd unflinchingly risked his life by going into the factory at Hilo's command, and future clan members like Lot's son and Anden. He asked them all to offer up their lives for the Brotherhood. He would never ask less of himself. Hilo swirled his glass and drank, then took the bottle and put it behind the bar before Ken could reach for any more. A horn could never afford to have his wits addled. "Ken," Hilo said, "if I die, you'll want to avenge me and take back my jade from Gaunt or whoever kills me. That's natural, but I don't want you to do that. I'd rather you took care of Wen. Make sure she has a good life, a good home. That's more important to me, even if you have to leave Kaycon, even if you have to turn." Ken was aghast. "I would never swear oaths to the Mountain. Never!" And Hilo remembered it wasn't just loyalty to him that drove the horn's vehemence, but the fact that the Mountain had executed Ken and Tar's father and cast his family into disgrace. The horn's voice shook as he said, "Why are you talking like this, Hilo Jen?" Hilo said, "I just want my wishes to be clear." Then he walked to the door. "We need to talk to the guys upstairs. They're waiting for us. And then we'll drive to see Aten's wife before we go to Sogan to sort out who will take Lot's place there." Third Interlude. By Jen's Triumph. In Kekkonese religious mythology, old Uncle Genshu, the one who returned, had a favorite nephew named Baijen, who remains the country's most well-known and revered ancient hero. Stories of Baijen, the courageous greenbone warrior, have been told to Kekkonese children for hundreds of years, and more recently, comic books and films have recounted his adventures and deeds. Unlike his divine Uncle Genshu, however, Baijen remains a mortal champion and is not worshipped as a god. According to legend, when Baijin was finally slain in furious battle against his greatest foe, the invading Tuni general, Shock, he was recognized by the gods for his valor and accorded a place in heaven. From his vantage point in the divine realm, Baijin looked down upon the earth. He witnessed his remaining men fighting and dying in his name, and saw that his people were on the verge of being conquered. He watched, helpless, as his beloved, grief-stricken wife prepared to throw herself from the cliff before the oncoming army could reach their mountainside home. In a panic, Baijin begged the gods to allow him to return to Earth for one night and give up his place in heaven to another. At first, his request was refused, but Baijin was immovable in his pleas. He wailed and beat his head on the steps of the Jade Palace, refusing to be deterred until Yato, the father of all, taking pity on him, agreed. The fallen warrior fell at the feet of the gods and wept in gratitude. That very night, he returned to Earth, sweeping over the battlefields littered with bodies, and entered the tent of the Tuni general. He burst in upon his shocked enemy, and, laughing in triumph, killed him where he stood in his underclothes. In accordance with the pact Baijin had made with the gods, the soul of General Shock flew to heaven. Baijin, the savior of his people, was left to roam the earth as an exiled spirit for all eternity. Greenbones have an old saying, "Pray to Genshu, but be like Baijin." Chapter 51. New Year's Eve. Preparations for New Year's week were muted in Jonlun. The city expected few out-of-town visitors this year, and locals were not in a festive mood. The two major clans, which normally each donated a considerable sum to public celebrations and charitable events during this season, were too besieged to arrange anything except minor community functions in their largest and most securely held districts. On every New Year's Day in Jonlun that Shae could remember, the Call family, led by their grandfather and later by Lan, would be out in public in the temple district, lighting fireworks, handing out candy coins to children, and accepting a stream of well wishes from lantern men. This year, Shae and Hilo sat alone at the patio table in the courtyard of the Call house, where they'd spent all night in discussion. There was almost nothing left to talk about now. Shae watched the rising sun smear the clouds with streaks of red over the roof of the house. In 48 hours, she might be the short-lived pillar of a clan in its death throes. Her duties at that point would be relatively simple. See to the proper burial of her brother, the safety of her remaining family members, and a somewhat orderly transition of power in exchange for a swift and honorable death for herself. Minimizing further bloodshed would be the most difficult part. There would be those who'd rather fight on, no matter how hopelessly. She was in possession of sealed letters from Hilo to each of his top fists in his own handwriting, should it come to that. She'd leave the more difficult conversation with the makes to Hilo. After a spell of silence, Hilo said, "I haven't thanked you for giving Wen that new job." "It was no trouble," Shae said. "She gave me a good idea of what she wanted." Wen's official new job was working for the weatherman's office as a design consultant on real estate development projects. It required a fair amount of travel. "I'm glad to see the two of you getting along," Hilo said. "I've gotten to know her better." Hilo smiled faintly. Shae thought he looked weary and a little distant. How these past months had eroded the boyishness of his face, damaged the ease and openness of his manner. He said, "The family was hard on you at the time, but now I'm glad for your Aspenian connections. I don't know how you pulled it off, but however you did, I'm grateful." He squinted into the sunrise. "You said we needed two things to survive. Money and a military victory. You delivered the first one, faster than I could get the second. You always were one up on me like that. She wished they could think of something else, some other way. Hilo's decision was awful. She told him so several times. But in the end, he was the pillar, and also the horn, in spirit, if not in title, and she had no basis on which to argue, no superior plan, or more cunning ruse like she'd had on Poor Man's Road. She'd done all she could, more than she could ever in good conscience admit to either of her brothers, to diminish the mountain's advantage over them, but it was still not enough. This might be their only chance, and at last she agreed they had no choice but to take it. "This is a terrible gamble," she said. "So was you meeting with Ait." Shay's face jerked up. When he saw that he'd unbalanced her, the smile on Hilo's face broadened, and he looked more like himself.
"Have you been spying on me?"
Even now, he could surprise and aggravate her with his arrogance.
"Having Khan follow me around again?"
Hilo's smile fell off his face. "Khan Yu is dead. He was killed at the Twice Lucky when Gaunt and his men took it." Shay stilled. She tried to connect the face of her handsome young neighbor to Hilo's deadpan words, and realized that the vague sorrow she felt was the barest portion of what Hilo carried. In recent weeks, he had seen many of his fists and fingers killed.
"Let the gods recognize him," she said quietly.
Hilo nodded, his eyes sad. "I haven't had anyone following you," he assured her. "Just a lucky guess is all, though I see I'm right. I figured Ait would contact you, that she'd try to convince you to kill me." He shrugged one shoulder. "It makes sense. It's what I would do if I were her." Shay sat back.
"You never brought it up. You weren't even worried?"
Her brother laughed a little. "Oh, Shay, if you decided to betray me, what could I do? What's the point of life if you can't even trust your own kin?" He kicked her foot under the table, a teasing, childish gesture. "For you to hand my head over to the mountain, you must really hate me. I must be such a terrible brother that I deserve to die. So there was nothing to be done about it." That was the way it was with Hilo. It always came down to the deeply personal for him. Shay stood up.
"I need to move. I'm stiff from sitting for so long.
Do you need to go, or will you walk in the garden with me for a few minutes?" "A few minutes," he said, and got up to accompany her. Wen was right. The garden was the most beautiful part of the Kaul estate, and she'd never really paused to appreciate it. The morning light was still foggy, illuminating the still pond and the late winter blooms. Bright pink cherry tree blossoms draped over dense shrubs, laden with sprays of small white berries. Hilo crushed one of them between his fingers.
"If you play your cards right, Ait might let you out," he said. "Exile wouldn't be so bad for you. There's plenty you could do elsewhere."
Faint bitterness in his voice. "I'd feel better about it." Shay thought of the meeting she'd had with Ait Mata in the sanctum and how it had ended.
"No," she said with grim confidence. "I don't think that will happen."
By dramatic and inexorable steps, she'd given up her chance at that other destiny. She'd hovered, gazing through that open door, and then she'd turned away. She was surprised to find, even faced with the probability of ruin and death, that she felt no great regret. At first, her decisions had been about herself. Then they had been about honoring and avenging Lan. And in the end, they had been about more than that. She could say to the gods on the day of the return that she had finally been the green bone she'd wanted to be, seeking, if never achieving, the divine virtues, but true to family and country and Aisho. She and Hilo kept walking, in a more companionable silence than she suspected they had ever before shared in their lives. She didn't want to break it, but then she pictured Lan sitting on the stone bench in front of the pond, watching the lazy carp and the rainbow sparrows that flitted on the birdbath rocks. She might not have another chance to settle her mind on this.
There's one last thing I need to ask you, she said to her brother. Ait told me she didn't order Lan's death, that no one in the mountain has claimed responsibility.
She waited.
Hilo, where is Lan's jade?
Hilo's gait did not break, but his steps slowed until he stopped and turned to face his sister. His face, bathed in shadow from a passing cloud, was suddenly unreadable.
I buried him with it.
Shay closed her eyes. When she opened them again, she felt them prickling with unexpected tears. So Ait had been telling the truth. No greenbone would have left jade on the body of a slain foe. Her brother had not been killed by an enemy warrior.
His death was an accident, she whispered in anguish.
It was no accident. Hilo's voice was cutting. He took a step toward Shay, his aura flaring harsh and bright in a tempest of sudden emotion. She'd never seen him look more dangerous than he did in that single step. He spoke with slow, deathly intensity.
There were two machine guns on the pier, and a dead man, a teenager. Ait and Gaunt sent at least two men after Lan that night. One of them got away, and if I'm still alive when Tar finds him, I'll force a jade stone down his throat and bury him alive to die slowly of the itches. Don't doubt, not for a single second, that the mountain killed our brother.
By sending a couple of jadeless thugs? She cried. Hilo's breaths were growing hard, as if he'd run some great distance. He took hold of his sister by the arms, his grip fierce, though she didn't resist, only stood limply, staring at him.
Lan was weak that night, Shay. He'd been badly hurt by Gom in the duel at the factory, but he didn't let on. He was carrying too much jade, trying to stay strong in front of the clan. I ordered an autopsy done that I never told anyone about. There was shine in his blood, Shay. Too much of it. Shine! Lan hated the stuff. He would never have taken it, but he must have thought he had no choice.
He released her abruptly and stepped back, his eyes black coals of implacable hatred.
The mountain always intended to conquer us. They broke us down, threatened and hounded us, ruined a good peacetime pillar like Lan. It doesn't matter what happened that night. They're the reason he's dead. I'll risk everything tomorrow to set straight that score.
You misled me that day, Shay said.
But there was no anger in her words, only bitter grief and acceptance. She felt, strangely, that it all made sense in a perfect and terrible way. It only confirmed in her mind that the will of the gods was a conspiracy of many things. People laid the tracks of their fate, yet were helpless at the same time. They'd all played their part in this, them and their enemies.
The mountain didn't even know Lan was dead when we attacked Poor Man's Road. We were the ones who came down from the forest first. We slaughtered 21 unsuspecting people.
Misled you? Hilo's eyes were pits. Never. You came back on your own, Shay, without a word from me, and thank the gods you did. As for those people, they were green bones. No green bone is unsuspecting of death.
Chapter 52. From Now Until the Last. That afternoon, Hilo went into the house and changed into his best suit. On his way out, he paused in front of the closed door of Kal Sen's room. Om saluted and stood aside to let him enter, but Hilo didn't go in. He stared at the blank door, perceiving his grandfather's slow but steady heartbeat beyond it, his raspy breath, the weak texture of his aura, so shadowy now that he was down to almost no jade at all. The old man was napping in his chair. He's tolerable when he's asleep, Hilo thought. As stunned and enraged as he'd been, and still was, Hilo admitted that the act of giving jade to Doru to enable the traitor to escape was the most himself that the torch had been in months. sneaky and subversive, unbending, righteous in his principled fury. Right now, it wouldn't surprise Hilo if the patriarch claimed the final victory in misfortune of outliving all his grandchildren. Hilo put a hand on the door, but could think of nothing to be gained from going in. He turned and went down the stairs, exited the house, and walked the short path over to the Horn's residence. When Wen opened the door and saw him dressed so formally, she backed away from him and put her hands to her chest, bending as if in pain. She trembled as he stepped in the house and put his arms around her.
"You've decided to go," she said.
"Yes," he said. "We have to be married today." Even though he'd prepared her for this possibility, she let out a desolate noise and sagged against him slightly.
"This isn't how I'd imagined it at all."
"Me neither." He pressed the side of his face to the top of her silken head and closed his eyes. "I was imagining the biggest banquet and the best food, a live band, and you looking lovely with your hair done up and walking with your hand on my arm in a long green dress. Or red. I like red just as well. I'd especially like it if the dress had a high collar, in a traditional style that's elegant and modest, but then also had a slit up the thigh to show off what a sexy piece you are."
"I already picked out the dress," she warned him.
"Keep it hidden," he said. "Don't show it to me yet. We might still have everything we planned for. The banquet, the guests, the music, everything. Later."
"We will," she said. "You'll come back after you've done what you need to."
He smiled and kissed her on the brow, touched by the certainty in her voice. "I will," he said. "But no matter what, you'll be safe. Shay has Aspenian connections. I don't know how she managed to do this, but she's arranged visas for you, your brothers, Granda, and Andin. She'll get all of you out of the mountain's reach."
"Kenantar won't go," Wen said.
"I've ordered them to. They can't stand the idea of running, but in this case, they're sure to die if they stay. Better to live for a chance to settle the score later. You'll have to remind them and hold them to my orders if it comes to that."
"If it comes to that," Wen said. "I don't think it will."
"I don't think so either," he assured her. "It's still important, though, that we get married today, just in case."
"Just in case," she agreed.
She rubbed the gathering of tears from her eyes and stepped out of his embrace.
"I'll get changed. Give me a few minutes."
He sat down in the front room and waited, thinking, as he looked around, that this really was a nice house, that he would have enjoyed living in it with her, the way it was now. Wen returned a few minutes later, wearing makeup, a soft, pretty blue dress, and a pearl necklace and earrings. Hilo smiled and stood to offer her his arm, and they went out into the courtyard to be wed. Judge Leto, a man well-trusted and paid by the clan, had been summoned to officiate the marriage. Ken and Shay stood as witnesses. The civil ceremony took only a few minutes, not the hour or more of chanting that would have been involved under Deitas tradition, but the legal marriage vows still hearkened to the divine virtues. "I will practice humility, putting my beloved before myself, expecting no praise or reward, for now we are joined in all things. I will practice compassion, giving gratitude for my beloved, suffering when they suffer, for now we are joined in all things. I will practice courage, protecting my beloved from harm, facing all fears from within or without, for now we are joined in all things. I will practice goodness, offering freely of myself to my beloved, honoring and caring for each other in body and soul, for now we are joined in all things. I make this pledge to you, and you alone, under the eyes of the gods in heaven, from this moment until the last one of my life." Wen's expression weakened, fighting tears as Hilo repeated after Judge Leto, reciting the final words. From this moment until the last one of my life. How long would that be? Hilo felt the vows settle into him, binding him with a different power than the clan oaths that had directed his entire adult life. Already, he felt a curious compulsion to try to reconcile the two sets of pledges, sensing the impossibilities he'd encounter in the attempt. Gazing at Wen's lovely, trusting face, he was struck with remorse that he couldn't, even with the consuming love he felt for her, promise not to break her heart. Because there were times a man couldn't be loyal to a brother and compassionate to his wife at the same time. A jade warrior couldn't truly be joined in all things with his beloved, not when he'd promised his blood to the clan. Wen took a steadying breath and said her vows with a strength that made him admire and appreciate her all the more. Ken stepped forward to tie their wrists together with strips of cloth, right to left on each side as they faced each other, and Shay placed the cup of Hoji in their joined hands. They both drank from it, then poured it on the ground to call forth good luck. Judge Leto pronounced them married. Hilo knew it was a poor wedding for the pillar of the clan. He was deeply sorry for having robbed Wen of the grand and joyful occasion she deserved. But the important thing was that she was his wife now, and if she became his widow tomorrow, she'd have everything he'd promised to leave her. The mountain couldn't touch assets bequeathed to family members through wills. Wen would have to start up a new life, a safer life, in Hispania. And for now, at least, he was her husband, and that made him happy. Happier than he'd been in a long time. He took Wen to the main house and up to his room, where he shut the door and undressed her and made love to her. They kept the soft lamplight on, and took turns guiding each other, not speaking in words, but with silent brushing of skin across skin, the contact of fingertips and mouths, the merging of breaths. Hilo ached to stretch this oasis of time to its breaking point. Whenever he crested toward climax, he denied himself and turned his attention to Wen instead, until she was spent with pleasure and whispering sweetly for him to give in. At last, with fierce desperation and quivering reluctance, he found release, and afterward tried to stay awake long enough to burn the merciful moment so indelibly into his mind that he could be certain it would be the last thing he would remember.
Chapter 53. Brothers in Arms. Andon arrived at the Call House late in the evening on New Year's Eve. The academy had let out for the holiday week, and throughout the day, students had been departing campus to spend the break with their families. Andon had been slow to pack his bags and leave. The pillar had spoken to him at length the day before, so he knew what to expect when he arrived, but for much of the day, he hadn't felt ready to face what lay next. Instead, he walked the grounds of the academy, trying to soak in the feeling of the home that he would soon be leaving. For many years, he'd thought of the academy as a place of necessary hardship and tribulation, of sweat and chores, of modest meals, little leisure, and unsympathetic masters. Now, though, he realized that it was a haven, a refuge where greenbone honor was an untainted goal. The only place where a person could wear jade and practice the jade disciplines in true safety. The 2 weeks of final trials had passed in a blur. After so many years of preparation and feverish last-minute studying and training, the conclusion of academic and martial testing had seemed almost anticlimactic to Andon. He'd been the most worried about his science and math exams, and they'd been the first ones in his schedule. After that, there were no major surprises. He improved marginally on most of his scores from pre-trials, especially deflection. On the last day, He wore his jade and fought four of the Academy's Greenbone teaching assistants in a row over 30 grueling minutes. By the end, he was exhausted and battered, but still standing, panting but ready to continue. It was not for nothing that Hilo had beaten him and taught him to always get up again. The masters made notes on their clipboards and nodded in dismissal. Andon had saluted them and walked out of the testing hall with barely more pride and triumph than he might have felt after completing a menial chore like washing the floor. At least that's over with. He would graduate. That was the important thing. These tests weren't real. The real ones were yet to come. When he got to the Call House, Andon went straight into the courtyard where the pillar was sitting at the shaded table with the entire family. They were finishing up a New Year's Eve dinner, and the delicious smells made Andon's mouth water. Roast suckling pig, seafood soup, spicy shrimp and sauce, pea shoots with garlic, fried greens. Andon only got food that good once or twice a year, but it was a modest holiday meal for a family like the Calls, who in the past had posted expansive public New Year's feasts. Andon stopped to take in the scene. His cousin Hilo was sitting at one end of the table in a black suit, his back to Andon. Wen leaned close directly on his left, her hand on his leg as if to hold him in place in his seat. Shay sat at the other end. Between them on one side were the Make brothers, and on the other sat Kal Sen in a wheelchair, with Kianla poised nearby. There was an empty seat and a place setting saved for Andon. For a second, Andon stood, the poignancy of the moment burrowing into him with a pain that made it hard to take another step. The picture was incomplete. Lan was missing from it, and so too was any sense of joviality. The voices were muted, the postures tense. Even from a distance, the gathering had the feeling of a funeral vigil rather than a New Year's family feast. Only Hilo seemed remotely relaxed or happy. He brushed aside Wen's reach for the teapot and personally refilled the cups around the table. He helped himself to another serving of roast pork, said something lighthearted to Tar, who nodded but didn't smile, and he wrapped an arm lazily around Wen's waist. Hilo looked over his shoulder at Andon. He smiled and rose from his seat to walk toward him. "Andy, you're late. There's barely any food left." He embraced his cousin warmly, then led him to his place at the table, next to their grandfather. "Sorry, Hilo-jen," Andon said as he sat down. "It took me longer than I thought it would to get out of the academy, and the traffic was bad. New Year's week, after all."
"You should have called me to send a car."
Hilo shoved Andon's head in mock admonishment and doled food onto his plate. Contrary to what Hilo had said, there was still plenty of it sitting on the table.
"The trials are over. You're not a student anymore. You don't need to be riding around on a bike or taking a bus."
"Congratulations on the end of trials, Andon," Shay said.
"Thanks, Shay-jen,"
Andon said, not quite meeting her eyes.
Their grandfather seemed to rouse from picking at the small morsels of food on his plate. He turned his wizened head toward Andon, his eyes suddenly narrowed and piercing in their intensity.
"So you're one of us now. Mad witch's boy."
Andon froze with a spoonful of soup poised in midair. He set it back down in his bowl, sickly warmth climbing into his throat and face.
Kal Sen said, "I hope you carry jade better than your ma. She was green, all right. A green lady monster. But she went out worse than even her father and brothers."
He leveled a bony finger and shook it at Andon.
"I said to Lan when he brought you here, that mixed blood boy is like a cross between a goat and a tiger. Who knows what he'll be?"
Hilo stared at his grandfather and spoke in a voice so lethal Andon cringed at the sound.
"Kianla, I think it's past Grandpa's bedtime, don't you?"
Kianla sprang up. "Come, come, Kal-jen.
she fussed, hurrying to pull his wheelchair from the table and take him back into the house.
Time to rest.
Mind your jade, mad witch's boy, Kaal Sen said in parting.
The table had fallen silent. Hilo let out a long sigh and threw his napkin onto the table.
He's not well, he explained to Anden apologetically. Losing jade tolerance does things to old people.
Up here.
He tapped the side of his head. Anden nodded mutely. Kaal Sen had never been cruel to him. When Anden had been 7 years old, the man had seemed like a god, and as recently as a year ago, he'd been strong and hale. He'd said to Anden,
"You belong in this family, boy. You'll be as powerful a greenbone as my own grandsons."
"Ignore him," Hilo said now.
"Go on, Andy. Eat.
The rest of you stop looking so damn gloomy. This is a happy night. Andy's finished the trials. I'm a married man. It's warm. Spring is on the way. It's New Year's Eve. You know what they say about the first day setting your luck for the rest of the year. Don't start it in bad spirits."
Anden forced himself to chew and swallow. He felt terrible. He'd made things worse by arriving. Putting on a weak but heroic smile, he said, "Congratulations on your wedding, Hilo Jen. You look especially beautiful tonight, Sister Wen."
"Now that's more like it," Hilo said.
"Thank you, Andy."
Wen smiled thinly, but Anden thought she was studying him with a particularly anxious expression. Her brothers, sitting opposite Anden, seemed the most unhappy tonight. Ken and Tar had not spoken a word since Anden's appearance, and when they glanced at him, it was with something approaching resentment. Anden avoided meeting their eyes. It was the place of the Horn and the Pillarmen to protect the Pillar with their own lives. They could hardly be faulted for begrudging Anden his part in what would happen tomorrow. Hilo said,
"You know what we should have had today? Candy coins. We always had candy coins on New Year's Eve when we were kids, didn't we, Shay?"
And gradually, limp conversation returned. Anden ate as quickly as he could manage, not wanting to prolong the suffering around the table. Kianla returned to clear the dishes, and the family stood slowly, lingering for a minute, glad for dinner to be over, yet reluctant to leave. Shay came over to Anden and put a hand on his arm. It seemed a deeply apologetic gesture, and Anden knew what she was apologizing for. With Shay so close, he could feel the jade on her, the slightly brittle prickle of her aura, a sensation that had been absent when he'd sat across from her over dinner at the barbecue house a seeming eternity ago.
"I was wrong," she said in a low voice. "I didn't listen to you. I know, Shay Jen," he said. "You don't have to say it. What you're doing now, I didn't want Hilo to ask it of you. I argued with him about it, told him he was putting you in a terrible position, but he's convinced it's the best chance of saving the clan. I'm sorry I couldn't talk him out of it."
"I understand," Anden said. "It's my choice."
Hilo whispered something to Wen, who nodded and departed with her brothers. The pillar said, "Come with me, Andy. Let's talk inside."
"Should I bring my bag into the guest room?" Anden asked.
"Leave it. We'll bring it in later." Hilo led him, not into the main house, but toward the training hall. When they got there, he flicked on the lights, and they blazed to life over the long wooden floor. A cramp took brief hold of Anden's chest. He remembered the last time he'd been in here, the last time he'd seen Lan alive. Hilo slid the door closed and turned to face Anden. The relaxed manner he'd displayed at dinner was gone, replaced with an equally familiar, dangerous intensity. It amazed Anden that his cousin could move between the two states with such speed.
"You've had a chance to think about it some more," Hilo said. "You think you can do what I'm asking?"
Anden nodded. He felt, suddenly,
as if this was the moment of true commitment. This was where his entire existence had been leading. The pillar was counting on him, and him alone, in the clan's time of need.
I won't let you down.
I know you won't, Andy. Hilo looked stricken for a moment. We need to prepare for tomorrow, but we should do this right. I'm asking you to act on behalf of the clan, on behalf of me, and that makes you a greenbone of no peak. The graduation ceremony hasn't happened yet, but you're through the trials, so you can take oaths. Do you know them by heart, or do you need me to say them with you?
I know them, Andon said.
He knelt on the floor in front of his cousin and raised his clasped hands to his head. His voice came out strong and steady. The clan is my blood, and the pillar is its master. I have been chosen and trained to carry the gift of the gods for the good and protection of the people, and against all enemies of the clan, no matter their strength or numbers. I join myself to the Fellowship of Jade Warriors freely and with my whole being, and I will call them my brothers in arms. Should I ever be disloyal to my brother, may I die by the blade. Should I ever fail to come to the aid of my brother, may I die by the blade. Should I ever seek personal gain at the expense of my brother, may I die by the blade. Under the eyes of all the gods in heaven, I pledge this. On my honor, my life, and my jade.
Andon touched his head to the floor near Hilo's feet. Hilo raised Andon to his feet and embraced him.
Brother, he said.
Chapter 54. Be Like Baijin. Late in the day on the first of the year, Hilo and Andon drove into the docks and arrived unmolested at the front of the Twice Lucky shortly before sundown. Hilo made Andon drive.
I want to make sure you don't damage my car on the way back, he said. It had been some time since Lan had taught Andon to drive in one of the family's old cars, and the teen was so nervous behind the wheel of his cousin's prized automobile that he crawled the monstrous sedan like an old lady all the way there, and Hilo teased him for it.
The Duchesse Prisa is a fucking powerhouse, and you're driving it like a pedal cart.
You could have had Ken or Tar drive, Andon protested.
I couldn't, Hilo said. You saw how upset they were last night. Their arrival was anticipated. The Duchess's slow approach had been seen and reported long before they got anywhere near the docks. So when they pulled up in front of the Twice Lucky and Andon turned off the engine, the first thing Hilo saw was that the parking lot appeared to be clear of any real customers. Only a few large black cars like Gaunt's ZT Valor were parked in the side lot, and there was a small crowd of mountain greenbones gathered in front of the entrance to the restaurant. Hilo waited in the car for a minute. He could perceive the eagerness of the men outside, and the implacable aura of Gaunt Ash rolling like a black boulder through the interior of the Twice Lucky toward the front door. And most clearly of all, he perceived his cousin's dread behind him, the rapid beating of Andon's heart, and he was impressed that the young man's face betrayed so little of his fear. Hilo put a hand on Andon's shoulder, rested it there for a few seconds, then got out of the car. He took off his jacket and laid it on the passenger side seat. Then he shut the door and strode toward the gathered enemy. After a moment, he sensed and heard Andon get out and follow 20 paces behind him, his heartbeat still loud in Hilo's perception. Gaunt Ash stood before him now, in a leather vest with Moonblade at the waist, flanked by a dozen of his warriors. Hilo stopped a short distance away. For all their mutual enmity, the two men rarely faced each other in person, and for the span of several unhurried breaths, they stood regarding the other. No one else spoke or moved.
they watched the unfolding exchange. At last, Hilo said,
"You know, this is my favorite restaurant."
"I can see why," rumbled Gaunt.
"Have you tried the crispy squid balls?"
"I eat them nearly every day," said the Horn of the Mountain.
Hilo's left eye squinted, and his lips pulled back in a tight grin.
"I'm envious."
He glanced up and down the line of seasoned mountain fighters, certain some of them were wearing the jade of his slain fists.
"All right," he said. "I'm here."
"It was a low thing you did to Aten, you fuckers."
He spat to the side. "Any man who challenges me with a clean blade, I'd give him respect. But you stole a warrior's dignity to get my attention."
"Well, you have it now."
Gaunt paced forward slowly, like an advancing lion. His voice was a cautious growl.
"If this were a dispute of personal honor, the two of us would have matched clean blades long ago, Kaljen. But this is clan war. We are horns who must do what we do for our clans to prevail. Is that not so?"
He circled Hilo, measuring him with deep-set eyes.
"I must admit, I did not expect you to come. I assumed I'd have to cut my way through every last greenbone in No Peak to get to you."
"You still want a duel? I'll give you one right here and now," Hilo said, following the enemy horn around with his eyes and perception.
Gaunt gave a low, snorting chuckle.
"That wasn't the offer. I'm not so selfish as to risk the outcome of a war on a single duel."
He stopped in front of Hilo, his broad frame casting a large shadow across the space between them.
"We both know the mountain will defeat No Peak in the end. Why let your loyal followers throw their lives away for you? Why drag out the suffering of this city we both care for? If I were in your position, I would think to the selfless example of Baijen."
Hilo was silent. An invisible spasm coursed through him. He did not want to die. He was certainly prepared to, but he didn't want to. He knew Gaunt could perceive the burst of conflicted emotions, but he didn't try to hide them.
"You gave me certain assurances," he said.
He nodded back to where Anden stood, some distance behind him.
"My cousin is here to make sure they're fulfilled."
Gaunt shifted his gaze to the teenager and motioned him over.
"Come here, Anden Emery."
Anden approached, calmly but visibly reluctant. Gaunt gestured him closer and closer, until the young man was near enough for the horn to place a large, meaty hand on his shoulder as they both faced Hilo.
"Do you know what part you're to play in this agreement between your cousin and myself?"
"He knows,"
Hilo said, his jaw stiffening at the sight of Gaunt's grip on Anden's shoulder.
"I trust him to stay out of it once it starts. He's to bring me back to the family. I want to be in one piece and with every stone of jade still on my body. If Anden returns safely and reports that everything happened as you promised, my weatherman will surrender control of the clan. I've spoken to my horn and written letters to all of my fists ordering them to lay down their blades and accept your terms. If you honor your bargain, she'll give these letters to them. If you don't, all my fists and fingers will fight to the last man to bring the mountain to its knees. You'd destroy us, but the victory would be hollow. Your clan would be crippled, and the city in ruins."
Hilo's words held absolute conviction. He meant what he said.
"We both know it could go that way, but neither of us is so selfish, Gaunt-Jen. That's why I'm standing here."
Gaunt nodded, a grudging respect in his eyes.
He released Anden and said,
"I give my word that young Anden here won't be harmed or interfered with."
"One other thing," Hilo said. "I want you to finish it. I merit a clean-bladed duel, and instead you give me this. The least I deserve in a death of consequence is to not go down in a careless hacking mess. Do you understand, Gaunt Gen? I want another horn to give me a warrior's death. After a moment, Gaunt inclined his head, a touch of dark humor in the movement of his lips.
I assure you it would be my pleasure, Kalgen.
Hilo ran his eyes through Gaunt's men. They had followed their horn, inching closer in anticipation, but now they halted and shifted back, sensing the change in the set of Hilo's body, the settling of his shoulders, the readiness in his knees. Hilo undid the next two buttons on his shirt and yanked the top of it wide open to reveal the long line of jade pieces studding his collarbone.
Come on, then!
He was suddenly impatient. He drew his talon knife, spun it around his index finger by the hilt ring before gripping it and dropping into the coiled stance of an experienced fighter.
Gaunt-Gen, show me which of your men is greenest with the knife!
Andon stood off to the side, Gaunt's weighty presence hovering near him. He stifled a gasp as the three mountain men circling Hilo closed in together. The scene became a blur of movement and slashing that Andon could barely follow. They were good fighters, these men who had stepped forward with their horns' permission. They wore jade through their eyebrows and ears, around their fingers and wrists and necks. They moved with supple ferocity. Yet they must have known right from the start that in volunteering for this worthy task, they were likely to die. Kal Hilo Shudon was a feared talon knife fighter, and now Andon understood why. The Kekanese talon knife is a hooked, double-edged 4-inch blade used for slashing, puncturing, hooking, and controlling the joints. Andon had seen Hilo's weapon. It had three jade stones set flush in the handle and was made of the same Da Tenori steel as the best moon blades. But unlike the moon blade, which has always been the quintessential greenbone weapon, the talon knife is the tool of the street fighter. Simple jadeless versions abound in Kaikon, and youngsters in greenbone families learn to handle it long before they ever touch any other weapon. Hilo fought as if he didn't even have a knife. He never looked at his hands or his blade, didn't rely on leading only with the right side, never seemed tense in the arm or overly conscious of his weapon the way anyone less comfortable would behave. He weaved and sidestepped and circled, deflecting his opponent's attacks and entering their space with his own. Except that each contact he made was punctuated with flashes of steel. One fighter came at Hilo with a high cut. Hilo hooked the man's wrist, slashed across the inside of the elbow, slipped the blade over the other arm, and drove up, slicing into and around the man's neck like paring a piece of fruit. It happened in a second. The man was not fast enough with his steel to follow the flurry. The knife cut into his jugular. He fell with a bloody gurgle. Hilo was already moving on, his eyes blazing motes of fire. So it was with the next man as well. Hilo returned one slash with three or four of his own in fluid succession. The next opponent caught Hilo across the ribs and then across the back of the neck. On most people, the talon knife would part flesh effortlessly, but Hilo's steel was nearly as good as Gaunt's was purported to be. Not so much in strength as in fluidity. A master of steel could direct his jade energy in a nimble dance of tension and release, avoiding hampering his own movements, flexing a shifting shield of near invulnerability at an instant. Andon stopped breathing for a second as he saw the blade part Hilo's clothes, yet only a trickle of blood stained them. Hilo grunted as he repositioned and threw strength into a left-handed strike to the throat. As expected, his opponent slipped and reacted, meeting the blow by stealing into his upper body. With a quick step, Hilo went low
and slashed the man across the femoral artery before stabbing into the back of the knee. The green bone buckled with a cry, and Hilo matched it with a triumphant snarl as he drove the knife tip between the vertebrae of the man's neck.
"You're wasting my time!" he shouted, dancing away from the body.
Sweat stood out on his brow and neck.
"At this rate, Gaunt Gen, you'll run out of green bones! If I'd known fighting mountain fists would be this easy, I'd have come around here earlier!"
"He's goading them on," Andon thought, despairing.
The mountain fighters who came forward now were not hesitant. They were infuriated by the deaths of their comrades and spurred on by the knowledge that even the best fighter is doomed to tire rapidly against multiple opponents. Andon forced himself to stand unmoving, to watch and not look away as the fight became a true melee. Hilo scrambled to stay out of the center of the storm. He slammed two men back with a deflection as he took on a third. He leapt light to avoid a simultaneous attack from two sides, but was dragged back down. He channeled into an attacker, but before he could finish the kill, he was knocked to his knees by another man's strength. Andon's breath grew shallow and panicked. His nails dug into his palms as glimpses of his cousin disappeared behind the blur of dark-clad bodies and flashing knives. Hilo's talon knife skittered across the pavement out of the circle of fighters, and Gaunt Ash bellowed,
"Enough!"
A few of his men, maddened with the fight, didn't obey at once, and Gaunt bellowed again, flinging his arm out in a wide, shallow deflection that sent his own green bones staggering. When they parted, Andon saw that the Pillar of No Peak was on his hands and knees, blood flowing freely down his face and across the back of his shirt. There was a rattle in his breath, and his shoulders heaved up and down. Suddenly, Andon thought of the time Hilo had come to the academy and handed him a beating just for the fun of it, to test what kind of man he was, whether he was the sort to keep fighting no matter how outmatched. Hilo had beaten him so easily that day, toyed with him the way a large dog pins and nips a small one. At that time, Andon had never imagined he would see this, the most ferocious of the calls, as helpless against his enemies as Andon had been against him. Gaunt strode forward.
"Enough!" he rumbled again. "You've taken enough green bone blood today, Call Hilo Shudon of No Peak. You deserve your warrior's death."
Gaunt reached for the hilt of his moonblade, and in that instant, Hilo propelled himself forward like a shot, tackling Gaunt across the midsection. The two men crashed to the ground together. Hilo spat in Gaunt's face.
"Did you think I'd offer you my neck like a duck on a fucking chopping block? I'm gonna take you with me."
And he raised up just enough to gather his remaining strength for a skull-crushing blow. Gaunt blasted Hilo back with a deflection that knocked the other man flat onto his back. Mountain fighters ran forward to attack again, but Gaunt shouted,
"Leave him!"
as he sprang to his feet, remarkably fast and light for a man his size. The horn stalked towards Call, who rolled to his feet with a groan and attacked again. Gaunt fended off the weakened man's lunge and hit him across the face. Hilo fell, but rose again, and again Gaunt dropped him, this time with a kick that buckled him across the ribs. Andon shook. His eyes, his throat, his chest burned. A wild and vindictively satisfied light had come into Gaunt's eyes, emerging from behind the heavy curtain of stony control.
"You are so persistent,"
he growled with each blow that sent Hilo staggering or collapsing, only to rise again.
"You don't know when to stop."
With a heaving of strength, Gaunt lifted the slighter man and hurled him bodily several feet. Hilo smashed into the asphalt, and this time, he didn't rise.
He lay like a broken and torn doll, and his chest barely moved in a gurgling, rasping breath, as Gaunt